Welcome to the Drunk Guys Book Club, where books aren't just for school, where book clubs aren't just for women, and in space, no one can hear you drink.
I'm Mike.
I'm Nate.
I'm Jimmy.
And we're the Drunk Guys, and this week we are reading the first of this year's 2024's Booker Long List, seeing and maybe stopping after this one.
After we adamantly told ourselves we were never going to do this again after last year.
Here we are. Strong gravitational pull or something. There was a space thing there. And we're reading Orbital by Samantha Harvey. And I'm starting with a beer. Fuck you. Because after I say the name of the beer, the episode's over.
Yeah, the book is so short, I have to open my beer now.
They're in space, right? And they're reflecting on all sorts of things. It's amazing how much navel gazing you could do in zero G. And one of the many things they seem to talk about is cosmic disorder? Not really, but kind of. And, you know, fuck this book. This is from Sand City, and it's a double IPA, of course. And it's very, very good. Nate, what are you drinking?
All right, so astronauts. They're, like, pretty good at stuff, right?
I can't believe you caught whatever disease Jimmy has.
They're pretty good at stuff, right?
They're usually, you know, top of their class, you know, like fighter pilots, all the, like, you know,
the cream of the crop
of everything. So, could you call them creme de la creme?
Literally.
This is Creme de la Creme by Other Half and Evil Twin NYC, and this is a 10% double dry hopped triple IPA brewed with milk sugar, and it is very nice.
Mm. I think at one point they did another version of that, like where it was Evil Twin with Other Half or something, you know, like they swapped, and it was Creme de la Creme de la Creme. It's like, how much creme is that?
That's so much creme. Or I guess it's like less creme, it's the creme of the creme of the creme.
Oh, true. It's we're getting into
inverted
homeopathic creme.
The picture on the can is a man in a broccoli suit drinking a beer.
I bet you that's Yeppe from Evil Twin, the owner guy.
It's definitely an Evil Twin style label.
So that's that. All of that, the part of the episode that everyone really hates. It's gonna be more interesting.
So join us next week.
So this is we're maybe gonna do the long list. We'll see how far we get. And this, we picked this one. We're like, oh, let's do the short ones first. And that was, it's never, we should have learned that's never the right thing to do.
None of them this year are particularly long.
That's what motivated us to do this. Do that. Plus,
arrogance.
We can't trust the degenerate gamblers. So Orbital is not this woman's first book. I've never heard of her before, but she is a book nerds writer, clearly. She's a PhD in creative writing. She just chose to not employ it when she wrote this book. And it takes place over one day.
I disagree.
In space.
Space.
Space, space,
space, space. Yeah.
There's no echoes in space, are there?
There's no sound at all.
Oh. So there's no sound in...
That should be the last 40 minutes of the episode. It's like, and now here's our space broadcast of it. It's just complete silence.
Get it?
Nate, why don't you tell us what the book is about?
Okay, so the book takes place over the course of one day, and it sort of follows the days of the astronauts on the International Space Station. And it's like sort of their inner thoughts and like what they go through and what their day is like and, you know, what they think about, what they worry about. But it is a book without a plot. Like, it is more just a, let's write something about what astronauts think. It's not, there is literally no plot.
It's a meditation.
It gives you a little bit of backstory about each of the astronauts and cosmonauts and what they're into, but there really isn't a plot.
The closest thing to a plot is they follow a typhoon that fucks up the Philippines, and the Japanese astronaut, or the Japanese-American astronaut's mother dies. Those are the only things they return to.
And the moon landing, which kind of didn't go anywhere. I mean, it technically went to the moon, but it didn't it didn't do anything with the plot. So anyway, we could talk about some of them. You know, the Japanese American one. I do not know how to pronounce her name.
I think it's Chie.
I
think so.
So this is like the essentially like chapter one. You know, they're all, so it talks about all of them, how they like get up in the morning, and there's all the stuff about, and each chapter is the orbit, like orbit one, you know, orbit one, ascending, orbit two, descending. And it talks about, you know, they have to get up, and it's like, kind of like this every day, and then they're sort of like have breakfast, but then together in their like astronaut food, and no, it's not just Tang.
They also have that freeze-dried ice cream you get at the Science Museum.
Which is terrible.
And like Dippin' Dots bullshit?
It's like flavored styrofoam.
In space, no one can hear you cream.
And Chie finds out that her mother has died. And she's very and everyone is very sad. And
she commits astronaut seppuku.
She throws herself out the airlock. No, that would have been a thing happening.
Yeah, that would have been great.
Which this book did not have. Though I still actually liked it. But, you know, and all the other astronauts, they, you know, talk about how they're like a community together, you know, and they know that they're from different countries and that after the end of their mission, they'll go their separate ways, but they feel like a community. And there's a funny thing about how, because the U.S., NASA, and the Russian space agency don't really get along, they're like, this toilet is only for Russians, and this toilet is only for Americans. And so they can't, like, sort of like the governments on the ground have arguments with each other. But the astronauts, they're like, no, we're not going to do that.
They're too confined to be that petty.
Oh, yeah. That would be like a nightmare.
It's kind of like the Mitch Hedberg joke about you when you get into an argument when you're camping and you can't slam the tent flap. Like, they're like, where could they go? It's like, oh, fuck you. This is my side of the tin can now. Like, oh, okay. Well, we all have to go to that one control panel or that one window. Like, we can't, you have to just deal with it. And there's also nothing the ground governments can do about them sharing the toilet. Like, what are they? No, I'm warning you. You know, like, no more Tang if you share that toilet. Like, there's nothing.
No, they try and bill each other. Like, NASA tries to bill the Russians for every time one of the Russians takes a shit in the American toilet. Although, which is crazy, but in their defense a little bit, everything in space is insanely expensive. Like, insanely expensive. Just to get it up to orbit is literally like the cost of its weight in gold.
But nothing weighs anything like in how space. Much
its weight on Earth. It's mass in gold. There you go. It still has mass in space, just no weight. So things are insanely expensive. So literally like that toilet cost millions of dollars to develop and then millions of dollars to like launch it into space. So
due to space inflation, every time they take a deuce, it's actually like a trice or something?
You can't have inflation either because there's no air.
God damn it. Though they are just breathing in recycled fart air at this point in their journey.
And at one point, the Italian astronaut's sole contribution to the plot is the time he tried to make garlic and made everything smell like garlic forever because the air can't be let out.
It was when he breathed.
He smelled the garlic smell in really his permeated.
They opened the airlock when his little meth vessel got up there, and they're like, welcome aboard. He's like, ah, and they're, oh, no. And it was ruined.
Another thing that happens is there's a typhoon, and they're like, and, you know, on, you know, NASA tells them, oh, when you're, go take pictures of the typhoon when you go over it. Oh, which isn't this orbit, it's the next one. Because the space station orbits the Earth every 90 minutes. So they have 16 orbits a day. So they're like, oh yeah, in about 90 minutes, you'll be able to see the typhoon. Go and take some pictures and send them to us so we can like, you know, release them. And they say that kind of thing happens all the time. And they're like, oh, go take a picture of this. And I'm like, yeah, sure, great.
Don't they have satellites that could be just way better at taking the picture than the astronaut trying to operate a digital camera?
So the ISS, I think, is in a different orbit. It's either much lower, because like geosynchronous orbit is like 30,000 miles away. Like it's a really long way away. Or it's actually a low weather satellite will actually be lower. And it won't have the right kind of like, it probably just won't have the right kind of camera to take a good picture, especially of the whole thing.
The ISS orbits the Earth at an average altitude of 250 miles.
It's very low, yeah.
Yeah. That's like here to Boston.
Yep, but straight up.
But wicked hard to get there.
Yeah, hard to breathe up there. Tom Brady could throw it up there, though. He could do it.
The balls wouldn't deflate.
Topical sports references.
They would, in fact, inflate till they exploded.
So, okay, fine. I guess it makes sense that they would do that. That's just like...
I mean, they're already there.
I feel like that's one of the things they ask astronauts to do so they could have something to show the public to justify their enormous expense.
Because it is incredibly expensive, so they gotta have to have some PR.
It'd be a million times cheaper to just send up a bunch of satellites that can do that job, which will do it better, and you could have, for every one astronaut, 100 of those satellites or something.
Well, the satellites are still very expensive, but yeah.
Yeah, but you don't have to feed them. You don't have to filter out their piss water into new water like it's Water World. You don't have to, care about them. And if when it dies, you don't have to have like a massive PR thing where school children get counseling because an astronaut exploded. Just like, yeah, so fucking space toaster broke. All right, whatever. We'll send another one. But it lacks the like
gravitas
fuck you communism thing that, no, I'm not going there, that NASA's accomplishments have.
In 1969, the White House had to draft a speech for Richard Nixon in case the astronauts died. So they landed on the moon, but in case the like rocket that was going to launch them back up, in case that failed and then astronauts were just going to suffocate and die on the surface of the moon, the Nixon administration, like the speechwriters, drafted a speech for him to give. And it was either not declassified, because that's not the right term. It was made public fairly recently because presidential papers are supposed to be made public after 25 years, something like that, maybe a little bit more.
This is what was on those missing 17 minutes of tape, him rehearsing the speech?
It's a dry run, yeah. He kept using slurs, so they just deleted it.
They had to be like, no, Armstrong is not a Jewish name, Mr. Nixon.
Are you sure?
I am. My name is Buzz. I found the speech. It's very brief, and it's ridiculous.
It just says, whoops.
Our bad.
Well, suck a dick, Russia. We sent a man to die on the moon first.
That's usually your thing.
Yeah. Okay. So, Nate, you liked the book.
Defend
what
it.
What happened? Yeah, seriously. Justify okay. this.
So, I mean, I guess we could talk about... we can talk about it. Yeah, sure. So,
what can we talk about?
Okay. I like space and science stuff. I'm sure that helped, although that I wasn't really getting my, like, you know, science fiction, like, oh, cool shit vibes from it exactly.
Yeah, it was not really like, it took place in space, but didn't have any like the sci-fi hallmarks.
No, I think it was mostly that, because I'm kind of on some vacation right now, I had the time to kind of read it slowly and carefully, though I still read it mostly today. I didn't feel like I needed to rush through it at all, and it was like, okay, this is nice. That's how I would put it. It's not bad, it's not good, it's just nice.
But isn't that the same way we describe macaroni pictures from children? Like, that's not ringing praise.
So, I mean, it's a thing that it's a perspective like you would never really get, you know, unless you're an astronaut that's done this, that's spent some time on the ISS, you wouldn't really get this perspective, you know. And it didn't go into any one person's story so much that you got like super bored, I guess.
Or super entertained.
Or interested, yeah. Or super interested, also a problem. But I just I thought it was nice when I was reading it. That's really all I'm saying. That was my opinion. I would, but at the same time, I was obviously thinking of Seven Eves the entire time while reading it. Because we just, yeah. I don't know what the order is coming out, but we just read Seven
That's
Eves
not coming
by
out
Neil
for months
Stevenson.
After this.
So, which is a really intense book with an enormous amount of like space scientific detail, but where a lot of shit actually happens. There's also a lot of technical detail, but where stuff actually happens. So,
there's way more technical detail in Seven Eves than was in this book.
Yeah. It really wasn't about the technical detail at all.
There's just enough. There's just and then there's the one almost completely plagiarized passage from Cosmos where it's like the universe, if it was a calendar and started on January 1st.
Every time there's a book about Cosmos like vibes, yeah. You know how humans are fucking up, they've always got to have some sort of metaphor about how recent humans are. You know, it's like a trope at this point. Like, it's what are we going to get compared to? Is it a clock? Is it a week? Is it lunch? Are we the antipasti? You know, like, what the fuck is it? But there's always some...
We're the bill.
We have just shown up after, you know, billions of nothing.
There's a video on YouTube. It's an hour, the entire history of Earth in 1 hour, and humans are the last 3 seconds.
Yeah.
I mean, it's helpful to understand...
Yeah, it puts it in perspective. But it is perspective, like every time now. I guess if you've never read another book... It's like, wow, I never thought about it.
It felt didactic in this use, in this book. It was like, this has nothing to do with the rest of the book. Because the rest of it was very much like, what are they thinking? And then all of a sudden, one of them was thinking, you know what would be helpful to remind myself? Man's place in the cosmos. Using a handy metaphor.
The point I got from the book, which... If you never read anything about space before, like real stuff, not like necessarily books, but like... what astronauts do. The thing they always say is like, it really makes you realize like, we're all the same together. We're all here together. Countries are bullshit. Like it's, we're all just humans. We can get our shit together. And that's what they always say. And so like hearing in this book is like, yeah, that's what they always say. Like if you've never really like read an interview with an astronaut or like anything like that, it might be like, wow, yeah, I never thought about that. But I mean, not that I'm some huge space nerd, but that is like, that's the number one thing that they come back with every time. So, you know, I guess it just kind of felt rehashed to me. Not that I'm some great scholar of the experience of astronauts, but it felt like a nice poem about stuff that we all feel that we only talk about sometimes, but it's stuff we all know.
Nate, defend it.
There was also the part where... It ripped off, we didn't start the fire.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Where it's just a list of things that have happened in the last, I don't know.
Skipped it.
In the closing second of the cosmic year. Yeah, it's part of that same thing. And it just sort of lists things that have all happened. And it's like, oh, yeah, and we didn't start the fire. You should have just put that in there, just right at the end.
I realized when there was a one line just said, Leonard Bernstein. I was like, when does that...
Also, throughout the book, the Japanese woman... writes lists because it helps her deal with being nervous. So there's just lists of random things throughout. Because she's like, not the main character, but the mainest character, I guess. She's of the, what, 6-7 people, she's 20%, as opposed to the other one's 13%.
She's the one that has a more memorable like detail about her, frankly. Like, then there's the woman who's English and her husband lives in Ireland with sheep, and they're like, all right, that's...
Yeah, she gets like two paragraphs. Most of them get like 2 or 3 paragraphs. The Japanese woman and like one other
Spanish
guy
whose wife is obsessed with the, I know the painting. I don't remember who it was.
Las Marinas.
Diego? Someone against Rivera? I can't remember the name of the painter.
So one, but going back to the woman.
Diego Velázquez.
One funny thing. The very first list, this is very near the beginning of the book. She's like, things, irritating things. Tailgaters, tired children, wanting to go for a run, lumpy pillows, peeing in space when in a hurry, stuck zips, whispering people, and the Kennedys. They're on the list of irritating things. And I was like, wait, what? And it just so happens, as we're recording this, that the story about how RFK dumped a bear cub, a dead bear cub in Central Park, has been like all over the news in the last 24 hours. Like, holy shit, yeah. You know what? Fucking the Kennedys, man.
No, you have to blame the worm in his head that made him do that.
It's true.
Yeah. Well, he probably got it from eating that bear.
Scoop the bear. Yes, yes, master. What you command. And then after he did it, the worm was like, I could rest now, and then it died. Fine. I mean, okay. But here's the thing. If you want a book that's about... Like the, I feel like, right, let me rewind. I feel like the author tried to do a lot of things where like, see it this way, and there's a whole bunch of stuff about geography. Oh, look how silly governments are. Oh, look how petty these things are. Great science fiction books do that and have a plot. Like, I was, like, this book is clearly one where you're supposed to, like, have a think after you read it. I was troubled after reading Seven Eves, like, thinking about what is the purpose of life on this planet? I was really distraught for like 36 hours thinking about how would I, like, what is the meaning of it? And there were 900 more pages of shit happening.
So actual stuff happening, yeah.
This book had none of the shit happening and just had the question. Like, I feel like she's like, you ever think about, like, what's this all about?
This is more like a guided meditation that you listen to while sitting in a chair or meditating, actually, than like a... I'm not going to say it's not a book, because it is a book, but it is...
It has pages and covers.
It's completely plot-free. Like, even the reviews are like, this is a beautiful thing. It is completely devoid of plot. Like, yeah, that's true.
The vacuum of space has...
sucked the plot right out the airlock.
No plot can be there.
So, we should talk about whether we think it's going to win the Booker.
No.
But I will say, there is a book like this that won. It's called Tinkers by Paul somebody. We read one of his books last year.
Oh, he wrote the one about the weird people in Maine, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What's that his
won
name,
the,
though?
Did that one? I won the Pulitzer, not the
I won the Pulitzer? The oh, okay.
There was like four Pauls last year.
Paul Harding. It was the Pulitzer, not the Booker. Okay. So, anyway, Tinkers, I read part of it. I definitely didn't read all of it, but...
Not a it didn't Thinkers? Have a plot.
It's too much for me. Yeah, definitely.
Stinkers.
But it won the other big literary award, really. And it is constructed like this. It doesn't have a plot. It's just kind of like nice prose about a thing. So it's not... So this is for like book nerd. Not just book nerds, but like book professors. Like literature, I don't know, real elitists. This is a thing that is... just as legitimate as a novel as one that has a plot.
Well, there were some beautiful passages. Yeah.
It was nicely written. Mm-hmm. There was some in there that was just like, oh my God, fuck you. Like,
I highlighted some.
This one, this feels to her what separates her universe and Sean's. I don't remember who said this. Doesn't matter. A tree made by the hand of nature and a tree made by the hand of an artist. It's barely any difference at all. And the profoundest difference in the world.
Oh yeah. Well, then you know what? I did notice there were a lot. She really returned frequently to the metaphor of the painter and the earth, which is interesting because it kind of felt like some like, what's the point? And it's like, well, it kind of sounds like you're almost saying God made this, right? Like, who is the painter? Who did the broad impasto strokes of Mongolia or whatever ridiculous passages there were? Who painted it? And like... But then that there's no point. Like, it just felt oddly disjunct because I don't think the point of this book was to be, oh, Jesus or something.
Reverence to our Lord and Creator.
I don't think it was meant to do that at all. I didn't get that vibe. Yeah. But then she really did that a lot. It's like, it's a painting that somebody made. It's like, well, that's kind of misleading. I found this. They inside making somersaults backwards and forwards because sometimes that's the only thing to do when you're falling. And falling around the earth. End of chapter. It just, every chapter ends like that, where it's like, whatever the poetry bongo playing equivalent of a mic drop is, a scarf sway.
It snaps.
But just like meant to be like, you're just like, oh shit, that was some knowledge that just got dropped on me.
I can hear the muted trumpet and smell the cigarettes.
Sorry, let me just adjust my beret a little bit before I go forward. It felt a little, and by a little, I mean entirely pretentious, this book. It was really...
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Because...
Though it is true that astronauts are falling. The reason why they're weightless isn't because there isn't any gravity 250 miles above Earth. It's because they're falling. But they're just moving sideways so fast that they just keep missing the Earth when they're falling down into it. And so they just keep falling 16 times a day.
So they're like Mr. Magoo, just like hitting staircases the wrong way.
I feel like that could be a much more interesting metaphor in a story, in this story, than what if there were no borders?
I also like there's a part, I didn't highlight it, where it's like we realize that all politics is stupid. You're in a fucking space station paid for by the governments of the countries you came from. Shut the fuck up. Okay. You're right. Your fucking Williamsburg food share is going to put people into space. That was just obnoxious. You can't... It reminded... That little snippet reminded me of Eat, Pray, Love, when these people are like, oh, don't you see how bad and how undisconnected we are from nature when you go to your ashram? And then they get on a commercial jet and fly back to America. Like, you can't have both. Like, you kind of... Like,
actually, like you can.
A, well, you can, but well, you can't mean
some of
both.
Us can.
You can't really mean it.
The ones, like, that, they, the ones that can afford it can have both.
It's ridiculous. I mean, in terms of the questions that we're supposed to ponder about the book, or I think we're supposed to ponder, those are interesting. And maybe, and this is not to sound snobby, but we did just read Seven Eves and a big space book where that was basically a thought experiment. We just pondered them. So this was bad timing for us.
I mean, the thought experiment of kind of Seven was, Eves yeah. was, what is the math I'll have to do if the moon explodes? This is like... What is
how long until women make racism again? Was the main
the answer is
question.
Right away.
They will instantly make racism. I don't want my children to look like that bitch. That was the plot.
When there's no government to constrain your feelings, we go for racism right away.
Except for the sea people who make. I can't remember the noise Jimmy made. The noise the seamen make.
Oh, I don't remember.
Blop, blop, blop. Whatever it was. Men choose semen every time. When it's women, they choose racism. Men choose semen. That was the thought experiment. But the questions are like, well, what is the point? What is the meaning of this, right? What's important? Great things to think about. And this book, thankfully, doesn't offer any answers. It just makes you a question. That's fine. I think that's a good thing.
And the questions to me are things that are, it wasn't anything new.
No, but you know, and this sounds obnoxious.
I mean, I've
too.
Seen Cosmos, so yeah, this isn't anything new. You're right.
I think, yeah, it makes me think of this, right? Like we are not particularly introspective people. I don't think, though. I think we do from reading a fair amount of literature and forced to think of these things from time to time. But the kind of person who's never considered this. Isn't going to read this book.
Yeah. The people who are reading the Booker list have all read books that had these things in them before. Or, you know, talk about them at their, you know, fucking book club.
Conflict-free vegan art shows.
Yeah.
The art is conflict-free. It's made on...
Is the art vegan?
Farm-to-table yarn.
It's just made with
I'm trying
celery.
To see who the judges are this year.
Oh, yeah. I meant to look that up.
And if any of them...
So while you look that up, here's the passage I thought was ridiculous. That I was like, what is this doing in the book? There's one part where it talks about the... I guess he was from Spain. I don't even know. The one guy who's thinking about his wife. And it says, this is the quote. There were some nights, about a month in, that he thought of his wife with an insane and afflictive longing. Okay. He thought of her bony nudity, tan lines, dark underarm hair, rack of ribs. I'm not sure if he's thinking about barbecue. Tied wrists, sweat on her breasts in the siesta heat.
Yeah, I do remember the tied wrists thing.
So he thinks about, isn't a siesta a fucking afternoon nap?
It's downtime in the middle of the day. You don't actually have to sleep. Most people don't take a nap necessarily. It's some time off.
I mean, an afternoon nap sounds sweet. But he thinks about tying his hairy pitted wife up so he could eat pork ribs in the afternoon is what I got out of that.
They could be her ribs.
Rack of ribs. We don't know what rack of ribs. Commas cannot always be helpful. That was a passage in the middle. Is this one of those things that's just here to see if you're still awake? Because it never gets back to like... Space jacking. Like, what does he do with that idea? The other thing about the astronauts is they're staring down at the Earth, and it's like a geography lesson. They're just like, there goes Turkmenistan, whose capital is who gives a fuck a jab? And, oh, look at the lights over Beijing. Interesting how dark North Korea is. Like, whenever they're thinking these obnoxious things. I thought astronauts were purposely, like, programmed all day. Like, they have shit to do. To keep them like on a schedule, like they don't have.
So not only are they incredibly busy with like things to do all the time. So back in the 90s, I think there was a ISS crew that went on strike because at the time they would get no days off. They were just like constant shit, experiments, maintenance, you know, EVAs all the time. And there was one ISS crew that were just like, you know what? Fuck it. They literally took a day off. They stopped talking to Houston. They just like stopped answering the radio. They just took a day for themselves. And NASA was so pissed. None of those guys ever got to go back to space. But since then, they give all the astronauts one day off a week. Like one day they get to just chill. But it is incredibly busy for them all the time.
So in this book, they're so busy. I mean, maybe they're very smart people and very accomplished, but they're super busy. And in the middle of, you know, like checking the bolt washers on subsection J of this panel, they're like, what does this all mean? I'm sorry. I just think the thoughts they would be having in that moment would be like, fucking asshole's itchy. Like, they're not going to be deep ponderings. They're going to be like, oh, that fucking Italian's cooking garlic again.
So one of the judges is a scientist, actually.
All right,
trained as a scientist, though. She's also won some literary awards. This is a Yun Li. I don't know how to pronounce her name, but it says trained as a scientist. She's a member of both the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Her work has appeared. And she's got a fucking a MacArthur Foundation fellowship.
She's a genius.
Yeah, she's got a fucking genius, and she's the author of 11 books. So one of them is a scientist, and you know what? Okay. Not that I was there or anything, but I bet it's like all English majors in one science major. And she's like, come on, guys, can I just have one?
Well, we've seen before, last year, I forget which comedian was on the thing. It was like a guy known for a sketch comedy show is his main thing. It's not to say he can't also know about books. I think they're trying to broaden the panel so they don't just keep getting the book that you would get every year. You know, the 600-page intergenerational family drama about longing and dealing with loss and the Holocaust or whatever, like the standard award bait kind of stuff.
Okay. I looked up this lady, Yun Li. She has her Bachelor's of Science from Peking University. I guess they don't change the name of that one. A Master of Science in Immunology and an MFA. So she's pretty smart, yeah.
She's very educated.
Very educated. But she's mainly a writer. She teaches fiction.
Okay, so I think what happened is she went to get that BA in hard science to please her parents and then realized, fuck this, I don't want to do that forever.
Okay, one of the judges is a musician.
They can't read. Is it a drummer? Because they can't even read.
Nitin Sahani is a world-class producer, songwriter, touring artist, club DJ, multi-instrumentalist, and composer for theater, dance, video games, and orchestras. He's recorded multiple albums and over 70 film and TV scores, which include adaptations of Midnight's Children, The Namesake, and as well as Mowgli, Legend of the Jungle. Wasn't that the like Disney remake?
That's the Jungle Book.
Yeah, the Jungle Book, yeah.
So, okay, so you got a Bollywood film score. That explains why all the books were short. Musicians aren't going to fucking read anything.
Some of them are definitely just English majors.
I mean, it's a literary award. They should be predominantly English majors.
For sure.
It's a literary award for English language literature. So that makes sense.
So I think we should introduce the drunk guy's criteria for are you going to win the Booker? Mike, do you want to walk us through it since it's sort of your idea?
Oh, sure. I forgot what the criteria
are. We've been right every time.
What's that?
We've been right every time.
Have we?
I don't know. I don't think so.
I think we've been close. Okay.
No one's going to go back and check, so I'm just going to say, yeah,
okay, basically, there's a couple different things that judges tend to like. One, is the book experimental? Is like a part of the rubric? Two, is the book like beautifully written? Does it have beautiful prose and just, you know, masterful use of language? That's not the same thing as being experimentally written. Experimentally written might be more like stream of consciousness, or it's written as a series of fucking tweets from a guy pocket dialing while he's, you know, riding in a bumper car.
I think at this point, if the book has quotation marks in it, it's not going to win.
That is a strike against it. Yeah, if it is, if it's,
I think, no. I think most of them at this point don't have them. They're just, that's like not a thing anymore.
There's also a strong, is there a political or social message that's timely of the book that tends to bump things up, especially from the long list to the short list? And then there's also the character quality. Like, is this author due?
Like, sometimes, yeah.
Has this author been around for a while and they're like getting up there in age?
Have they made the list 5 or 6 times already and not won?
There is an award. There's something they give it. I forget. It's Beryl Bainbridge or something like that was her name. An author who was shortlisted a bunch of times and never won it, and she's dead now. And I think there's an award given in her name.
Always a bridesmaid, never a bride award.
Exactly. I think I'm forgetting something, Nate. What else is there? And what else?
I think those are the main things. It's kind of like, in order to win the Booker, it has to have, it has to be both about a really important social issue, like apartheid, or the Holocaust, and be at least somewhat different, experimental in writing. It can't just be like a pretty good regular novel about apartheid. Although that's not true. Actually, the one about apartheid that won like 3 years ago, that was not that experimental. But it was about apartheid.
It changed. You're talking about The Promise?
Yeah, The Promise.
Damon Galgut or whatever. It changed perspectives. It had different characters' perspectives each time, and it was weird. Each section. That was kind of weird. And okay. Not conventional, at least. Maybe you should call it that. Not conventional writing.
Yeah.
Or not conventional storytelling.
So this book has an unconventional writing style in that they decided to forego having a plot. That's
bold. You
know, in terms of a novel, I mean, the definition of novel is very expansive. So much like space, it's big. So really, really big. So you can have this thing without a plot also be a novel. But anyway, it's so that's the kind of more experimental thing. It's like, it's just about astronauts, but it's not, doesn't have a plot. Now, is it about an important social issue? Well, she tries to shoehorn it in there, that's for sure. About, like, you know, what's the use of borders? And, you know, we need to come together. And, like, yeah, it has that too. But, in my opinion, it's not going to win the Booker.
I agree. I mean, you can't have the social issue be world peace. That's too big.
That's the Miss Universe answer.
Yes. She does. There was a lengthy part there about global warming and climate change or whatever. But then it's not really like a focal point of the book.
It doesn't have any focal points.
Right. But it's not like, or a through line. I don't know. It's just like one of the many musings of the astronauts.
There's a chance that tell me if you think this is true. That there's actually another criteria, there's another requirement that the book has to be really fucking sad for it to win the Booker, which...
It is, there have been comedies. The last, like, overt funny book to win, I think, was Vernon Godlittle in 2003.
Though the Sellout.
The Promise and The Sellout were funny, but they were...
Dark.
Dark, like, black humor, especially in The Sellout's case. Hey-o!
I think that that's a thing in not just the Booker, but in all awards, is like comedy isn't judged as seriously as drama is just because someone said so.
Because we think of dramas are serious things and comedies are at least in some people's estimations, definitionally unserious things.
If it's funny, it can't be serious.
But satire is an interesting thing there. But I just kind of ignore that.
Yeah.
I mean, satire, it can... can be important, but still, I feel like many of the Booker, not only nominees, but also winners, are just like so sad, just like devastatingly sad. And this one kind of wasn't, actually. It was just kind of like, eh.
Yeah, it wasn't happy or sad.
If we're going to accept that one of our criteria is it has to be about an issue, it's kind of hard to address the issue in a, not serious, but, you know, meaningful way. With and be silly or be funny at the same time. That's really hard to do. That's why they're
like a comedy about apartheid.
Ooh.
Right. The comedy about apartheid is like a sitcom. It's like a what the fuck was that called? The Jeffersons? similar, but it's like a black family now. They've been resettled next to a white family. And like, I can't stand how loud these people are. And they're just criticizing the white neighbors. Like, that just feels, I mean, it'd be kind of funny. But that would be not, you'd be like, that, you've missed the point.
Yeah.
It was terrible. Like, you can't make light of it. Though maybe if things are long ago, maybe there's some quotients there. Like, things that are too recent and people remember, you can't be, flippant about that.
Was Life is Beautiful a comedy? No,
Life is Beautiful.
Something it's disguised Italian, as
so
a comedy.
They're just inherently unserious people. Have you seen that movie, Nate?
A long time ago.
Oh, that's a very sad movie, actually. It has silly things.
It's got clown makeup on a very sad movie.
Yeah, sure. You can see that.
Yeah, it's like, a funny book. It's
like that scene in Schindler's List where he tells a bunch of knock-knock jokes.
The list is actually a list of jokes.
oh shit, that would be...
Schindler's List of jokes.
Thoughts we see, these are all funny. Okay, so by that criteria, I don't think this book has a snowball's chance in hell of winning. And my own personal animus towards it shouldn't win. So
this is the first one we have read of the 13. I don't know if we'll read all 13, but we'll read at least fucking 8 or 9 or 10 of them, depending on timing.
Yep.
But so I don't know what to compare it to at this point, but I would be surprised if this was the best one.
Me too.
It was perfectly fine. I don't know why it's on this list.
So because the scientist on the judging panel needed a win. She needed a win.
She's a scientist. She's studied immunology.
She's a scientist.
See what happens when we listen to the immunologists. She's a plant from Fauci. She's yeah. This shouldn't win. And should anyone read it?
Well, I kind of enjoyed it. I still like, who would I recommend this to? Like, I don't know. I don't think I would.
It's probably for either really, really, really smart people who get a lot out of it, or people who are not that smart but pretend that they are. They want to pretend they got a lot out of it.
It's like an Oprah's book club book.
This is a fucking performative, heady book. I'm sure
deep insult.
There's a lot to get out of it, but I'm sure it's more commonly going to be used by people who said like, "Oh yeah, what an amazing masterpiece." And they go back to watching Real Housewives or Monster Trucks. I don't want to sex discriminate. Though I'll tell you, Monster Trucks in person are pretty cool. Once.
And much like the Real Housewives, kind of scary. yeah, I think that's all fair. But, you know, we invariably missed everything, as we do with all books that are serious and people have strong opinions on. But why don't you tell us what you thought?
Send us an email to drunkguysbookclub@gmail.com.
Or follow us on Twitter, DrunkGuysBC.
Or go to Facebook and Instagram at DrunkGuysBookClub.
And if you want to help support us to continue reading as many books that we don't get or like, head over to patreon.com/DrunkGuysBookClub to support the podcast.
Sell it, Mike.
And yeah. You can join us on Goodreads and see the list of all the books that we didn't understand. And neither can you.
And check out the Hopped Up Network, a network of independent beer podcasters. And thanks for listening.